Welcome to the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast, a view of culture, current events, and politics through a biblical lens, with your hosts, Neil Boron, Bob Duco, Roger Marsh, and John Rush. Now let's join the conversation.
Very happy to be back with you folks for another week of the National Crawford Roundtable with John, Roger, Neil, myself, Bob. Gentlemen, how are you this week?
Hi, Bob.
Good, well, Bob.
How you doing?
Always good catching up with you. Everybody get your Christmas shopping done? I hope so. I'm guessing not.
Nope. Not so much.
Or, yes.
Yeah,
nope.
You know what? We're guys. Who are we kidding? Okay, for
That's
us.
Right.
For us, it's Christmas Eve at the end of the night, and it's usually a gift certificate from 7-Eleven. So we don't kid ourselves.
How did you know?
I know, exactly. Well, you know, one of the great things about being a guy, I've always said this, is that we get credit for the slightest little thing, okay? Our wives go do all the shopping. They do all the – if it's our, you know, our mother's birthday or something or Christmas card, what they do is they go get the card, they sign it, they write our name. They have us just sign our name one time in the bottom corner after they wrote a bunch of mushy stuff themselves, send it off to our loved ones, and then we get credit for being such a thoughtful son or brother or nephew or whatever. So it's great being a guy.
Amen.
Now, we're going to talk this week – about what happens next regarding the Electoral College. They've voted already, but then you also have this other slate of Republican electors. And we want to get into what happens now and over the course of the next really few weeks leading up to Inauguration Day. Next week, of course, we'll be doing a lot of Christmas-related discussion. The week after that, we'll be talking about a 2020 year in review. But for right now, before we even get into the Electoral College vote, John, there was some big national news about something in your backyard. John Rush, of course, host of Rush to Reason from Denver, Colorado, that this church, this High Plains Church, they sued because of the COVID restrictions that have been placed on the capacity that they can have in the church. And the Supreme Court ruled on this in favor of the church, and remarkably, they ruled 6-3. So it's like John Roberts just suddenly remembered, oh, wait, here's my conservative ID card. Okay, I guess I'm a conservative today. But I was glad to see that, no surprise, Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito sided on the side of religious liberty, but all three of President Trump's nominees to the Supreme Court as well, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, all three of them were solid conservatives. John Roberts was a conservative du jour for that day yesterday. And no surprise, the three liberals, Stephen Breyer, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor said, no, forget the churches, you know. So that, I think, is a fairly significant ruling in sending a message across the country to these Democrat governors that you better stop trying to restrict religious services. Now, John, if Christians would just say, okay, well, then maybe we'll go to church and maybe we'll demand of our pastors and our boards that they actually open.
Yeah, Bob, that would be the ultimate question when it's all said and done, because frankly, we're not seeing that. And, you know, there's a few churches in Colorado that have essentially, you know, defied orders, have said, listen, we're going to stay open. We're going to do what we need to do. But we've got some very large, prominent churches across the Front Range here in Colorado that are still, you know, really, you know, kowtowing, if you would, to Governor Polis in what's going on with his, I call it the regime, because that's what it is, literally kowtowing to him. And I, for the life of me, have yet to figure out why churches across the country, but especially in my own backyard, have not all just defied the orders and said, listen, we've got churches here, guys, that have auditoriums that'll seat 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people that aren't holding services. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
It is. Well, actually, Roger Marsh from the People's Republic of California, Roger, what we really need basically is for John MacArthur's attitude to spread across the country, really, because John MacArthur has been such a champion in this area. I'd like to see my own personal church reflect the attitude of MacArthur and some of the churches that have been willing to say, look, we're opening.
It's interesting you bring up John MacArthur, because remember this summer we were looking at his case and the L.A. County, you know, health officials going after him in the church, and there was this a fear of a pandemic that actually spread because a couple of people had reported testing positive for COVID-19. It turned out in a church that has, what, 8, 9, 10,000 people worshiping on a Sunday, they had three members of the congregation who tested positive for COVID-19. So, I mean, it's three, I mean, out of that sample size, absolutely ridiculous. But what's interesting is as the county has been getting their hands slapped, and this would be an encouragement to other pastors who are saying, I don't know if we can do this. It seems like it's a bit much. John MacArthur in the headlines in the People's Republic of California in the last 2 months, exactly no times. It's as if they stood up to all the challenges. They got the, you know, the hearing scheduled for when they're supposed to be able to open. They're still meeting, and the county backed off. So if that could be an encouragement to any pastor who's sitting there saying, gosh, I don't know if I can open my church up again, you know, quite frankly, do it and see what happens with your county department of public health. They've got a much bigger fish to fry in L.A. County right now with the number of people in hospital beds, you know, going way up, and the number of infection rates and the mortality rate that's all being attributed. It's all reported COVID-19, and we'll have to see if it does, in fact, actually turn out to be. But you're right. John MacArthur kind of set the standard on this one as far as churches attending, and regardless of who's in the White House, this is still, you know, an issue, I think, for the church to say, this is a place where we can peacefully protest without having to turn our churches into strip clubs, so we can do it.
Neil, Neil Boron live from Buffalo, New York. So what do you think, Neil? Churches need to take on Andrew Cuomo?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely respectful of churches if for whatever reason, maybe their own pastor or their leadership, you know, falls in the high-risk category so that they're prayerfully considering how their church ought to approach things and still instituting, you know, reasonable protocols and stuff. But the idea that we cower in the corner and just hide in fear just doesn't make sense. And, you know, because we have the constitutional freedom to do it, we should be standing up. So God bless John MacArthur and others like him. In New York, it's been kind of a mixed bag. I just was talking with one pastor from a local church, kind of a rural congregation, but a thriving one. They have about 400 members in their church. They opened up in July and they just kept meeting. And they talked about it openly with their congregation. The congregation said, we want to meet. This past Sunday, I was talking with them recently, this past Sunday, they took 29 new members into membership, and they're running some kind of a day program for the schools that have shut down so that kids from kindergarten through 12th grade can come. They get sectioned off into various parts of the churches, and volunteers and others are having opportunities to help those kids with, you know, learning programs online and otherwise. And one of the local school districts is now providing food. So the kids are getting fed breakfast and lunch. It's kind of like door-to-door evangelism in reverse. You can't believe how the parents in those communities are thankful to the schools because they have somewhere to send their kids so that single moms can go to work and earn a living for their family. Anyway, it represents great opportunity, but what I really appreciate about that pastor in particular is that his confidence is in the Lord, and he's not being silly, he's not being stupid. By the way, he's a four-time cancer survivor, so if anybody would be at high risk, it would be him. He just said, you know what? This is when the church needs to be the church. This is when we have to stand up and bring light into the darkness and despair that people are feeling. And God bless him. He and many others like him are doing similar things. And I'm just grateful that somebody's got the courage to stand up and meet in the middle of this thing.
Wow. Hey, Neil, I want to jump in here on something you said that I really resonated with me, too, with regard to the churches being able to make a decision whether or not to open. My church congregation, we have a school, a JK through 8 school, that got waivers from Orange County back in the summer, and they're complying with everything. And the school is not only still in session, but we're turning people away. We have waiting lists in every class grade level because the number of parents who have kids in public school say, hey, if you guys are reading in classrooms, we don't care if it's a, you know, whatever the tuition is, this is what we're going to do. But when it comes to worship on the main congregation, we have a really large patio area just adjacent to the sanctuary. We've moved everything out there because we're in a retirement community area, basically Laguna Woods, California. There's a high risk of, for the vast majority, probably 80% of our congregation falls in the risk category. And the ones who want to stay home are watching on Facebook, and the ones who want to come are hanging out in the patio right now. So we don't feel as though we're horribly inconvenienced. But for the larger churches, to John's point, you're right. I think it's criminal that a church that large, where the congregation says, we want to meet, shouldn't be able to do so. So I really believe it's in the hands. I want to just reiterate, I agree with you in the fact, let the congregations decide, don't let the state decide.
Absolutely, right. Absolutely. And by the way, as Christians, and certainly I would argue pastors and elder boards, they need to be a little bit more courageous in the face of COVID and maybe do a little bit more research instead of just drinking the Kool-Aid of whatever ABC and CNN tells them about COVID and the dangers and the threats and everything else. And then maybe, just maybe, they could exercise leadership more in this country and say, you know something, we're getting back to church, we're getting back to normal. And wouldn't it be nice if the churches presented the leadership model for the rest of the country, the secular country, to say maybe we need to start getting back to normal like the churches. But instead, hate to say it, so many churches are pretty much just following along with everybody else that's bought into the hype and the fear that the media has presented. So it's unfortunate, but there are some that are standing out, and we're glad to see that. All right, let's do this. Let's take a short break, and then we will start talking about what happens now after the Electoral College has voted on Monday of this week? What about the Georgia race? And just a lot of different aspects of what happens now over the course of the next few weeks in this transition time and the what appears to be fizzling out of the President Trump legal efforts. So we're going to continue this conversation a couple minutes from now here on the National Crawford Roundtable.
Be transformed by the Word of God with Alistair Begg in Truth for Life. Every weekday, Alistair Begg teaches the Bible through in-depth verse-by-verse attention to the Word of God. You can listen to Truth for Life on your local Crawford broadcasting station or listen online at truthforlife.org. Please support this important ministry with your donations at the truthforlife.org website or by calling 888-588-7884, and be sure to let them know you heard about Truth for Life from the National Crawford Roundtable podcast.
Continuing the National Crawford Roundtable podcast with Neil Boron from Neil Boron Live out of Buffalo, New York, Roger Marsh from The Bottom Line in the People's Republic of California, John Rush, host of Rush to Reason from Denver, Colorado, myself, Bob Duco Show out of Detroit. Okay, guys, let's shift over to the election. The Electoral College voted on Monday, and we know for people that aren't familiar and maybe just a little bit of Electoral College 101, remember, a state has Electoral College votes based on the number of U.S. House seats and the number of senators that they have. So, for example, here in Michigan, we have 14 U.S. congressional districts. We have two senators, so therefore we have 16 total delegates, if you will, representing Michigan and Washington. That means there are 16 Electoral College votes, electors. However, there are 16 Democrat electors and then 16 Republican electors. Theoretically, whichever candidate wins the state, then that means that that candidate's party's electors are named and seated and activated to cast their votes on what was December 14th this year, whereas the other party just goes home. What happened, of course, on Monday is that you had the electors in all 50 states cast their votes, which came out to 306 for Joe Biden, 232 for Donald Trump. However, there were a handful of key states where the Republican electors, even though Joe Biden, quote unquote, won that state, the Republican electors are like, no, we say Donald Trump really won that state. We're casting our votes also. And those votes are being also submitted to Washington, D.C., to Mike Pence. So we got a handful of states that have done the alternative slate of voting as well. I don't think it's going to make a big difference, but let's kind of go through the rundown of what happens from this point. And is this over? John Rush, has the fat lady sung in this effort to right what a lot of us consider the wrong of this election?
I believe so, yes. I think it's, you know, is there an ultimate long shot, you know, Hail Mary pass at the end of the game to try to win the thing? I'm not a constitutional expert by any stretch of the imagination. Folks, I and we've talked about this on the podcast in the past. If they were going to bring the smoking gun out and make that final shot at trying to win the election, my feeling is that time has passed. Again, I'm not a constitutional expert, but I think it's high time our side started realizing what the future holds in regards to the next at least 2 years with a Joe Biden presidency. And the reason I say 2 years is because midterm elections have huge consequences, right, and it may change dramatically along those lines. So I'm not even saying 4 years. I'm just saying the 2 years that, you know, we now need to kind of figure out as conservatives, what do we do? But yeah, in my opinion, yes, I think, you know, I waited in even on my show until you know, the Electoral College cast its votes. But at this point, guys, you know, unless there is some miracle out there I don't know about, which honestly, I just don't see coming. Yeah, it's over.
All right. And Roger, none of us, of course, are constitutional experts, but at least in the research that I've done on this, it seems like the only razor-thin possible path for President Trump, and this doesn't seem plausible at all, is that A, the Supreme Court ends up taking one of these smaller cases that are still out there to basically invalidate a bunch of ballots in Wisconsin, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and then it puts pressure on the U.S. House of Representatives to now consider taking Republican electors for those states. If the Supreme Court didn't take the Texas case, they're not going to take any of these other cases, so I consider that dead. It seems like the only other constitutional option, Roger, is for somebody, as the Constitution allows, somebody from the House and somebody from the Senate to object to an individual state's electors, like we'll say Pennsylvania's, for example. Now, there are Republicans in the House that say they're already planning on objecting. This is on January 6th during a joint session when Mike Pence, as president of the Senate, is overseeing and counting the votes. But it would require somebody from the Senate also. Mitch McConnell, I think, put a death nail in this on Tuesday of this week, or Monday, when he said, you know what, that's it. We're accepting that it's President-elect Joe Biden. We need to move on, and actually telling the people in the Senate, don't object. So at that point, I don't even think Ted Cruz or anybody from the Senate's going to object. But let's pretend one of them did, and now you have somebody from the Senate and somebody from the House. All that means is they debate it, and then ultimately they vote in the House and the Senate for whose electors to accept in a particular state. We know the House is going to take the Democrats' electors. In the Senate, even if we win Georgia, both seats, and the Senate has a 52-48 Republican, there's no way that Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, and a whole bunch of other wimpy rhino Republicans are actually going to vote to throw out those Democrat electors. So therefore, it seems to me, Roger, John is right. The fat lady is sung. I just don't see a plausible path at this point.
Yeah, you know, and I agree with you, too. When you consider that the only voices in the Senate who have even made a sniff at that would potentially join up with something like this are Rand Paul and Ron Johnson. So, you know, yeah. Rand Paul's always on the other side of, you know, whatever. He has right. No trouble, you know, speaking his mind. And good for him for doing so. I have a lot of respect for him. I don't always agree with him. But I think it's really, you know, it's helpful that he does. I mean, the reality is the Republicans got outplayed on this one. And it's unfortunate. You know, I mean, whether or not it's a stolen election, only time will tell. But when you consider the plethora of lawsuits that have been filed and all summarily dismissed by judges on both sides, I mean, especially some who were appointed by President Trump during the past 4 years. If for some reason the president naively thought, well, I put you in office, so therefore you're always going to side with me, then, you know, that's bad on him. But the fact that not only were there so many legal challenges from Republicans after the elections, there were 300 plus legal challenges by Democrats before the elections to get all these laws passed. And so now it really just becomes a question of how many different challenges can you issue? You know, let's look at the voting machines and the election integrity. There's no time for that at this point. I'm with John. I don't like the song that's being sung, but the fat lady's definitely singing. And now it's just a question of what happens in Georgia. You know, and I think a lot of people are a little discouraged because if you're of the opinion that the election was somehow stolen or rigged, or you know, yeah, I think it was legally rigged, but it was rigged nonetheless, then that the election results there. I would be pleasantly surprised if one of the GOP candidates in Georgia wins, but if it becomes a blue wave through Georgia where there are 164 counties and 162 of them are red, but for some reason the whole state decided they wanted two Democrat senators, then we would just have to, you know, count your losses and re-gear and re-up for 2022.
Yeah. Neil Boron, what's your take? Do you see the fat lady as having sung? And more importantly, I suppose, than that even, is where we go from here. How do we now respond to this? And I know we got to take a break, Neil, but love to get your take on that.
All right. Well, we'll do that right after the break. You're listening to the National Crawford Roundtable.
Learn how to walk the narrow path with Steve Gregg. With over 40 years of studying the Bible, Steve Gregg is passionate about teaching you how to apply scriptural wisdom to every aspect of your life. Listen to The Narrow Path on your local Crawford Broadcasting Station or online at thenarrowpath.com. The Narrow Path is 100% listener-supported. Please keep this vital ministry going with your generous financial support and let them know you heard about The Narrow Path on the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast.
This is the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast. My name is Neil Boron. Bob Duco is leading the conversation out of Detroit, Michigan. John Rush in Denver, Colorado, and Roger Marsh in the famed People's Republic of California. We love you, Roger. You're awesome. Has the fat lady sung? Yeah, and I think she's warming up for the reprise now. I just think it's over. But let me ask you this, because I can't add anything to what you guys just shared. I was reading a CNN Politics article, and they kind of spelled out, you know, what happens with the Electoral College. And I'm not super familiar with it myself, or I'm not a constitutional law expert. So here's what they say. On January 6th, you know, members of the House and Senate meet in the chamber. The president of the Senate, which is Vice President Pence, presides over the session. The electoral votes are read and counted in alphabetical order by two appointees, each from the House and Senate. Then they give their tallies to Pence, who announces the results and listens for objections. Now, those are the results of what just happened, right, on December 14th. So it's the results of the Electoral College vote, which went for Biden. It says, if there are objections, somehow multiple states of electors put forward by a state, the House and Senate consider them separately to decide how to count these votes. Then it says there are 538 electoral votes, one for each congressman and senator, plus three for Washington, D.C. If no candidate gets 270, the 435 members of the House decide the election. Each state gets a vote. While there are more Democrats in the House, Republicans as of now control more state delegations, so it's very possible the House could pick Donald Trump, even though there's a Democratic majority. It requires a majority of state votes to become president. The House has until noon on January 20th to pick the president. If they can't, it would be the vice president or the next person eligible in the line of presidential succession. What does that mean? I don't get what that means.
I can kind of simplify that for you. What that means is that when Mike Pence on January 6th, when he receives the votes that are presented from the individual states, and let's just take a state that's contested right now, Pennsylvania. Okay. What's going to happen is Pennsylvania, someone from Pennsylvania will declare and present 20 Electoral College votes for Joe Biden. Now, there were 20 Republican votes cast by the Republican electors as well, but those aren't official. Those are kind of unofficial. So what would happen then is a House member, a Republican, would stand up and say, I object to those 20 being allocated for Joe Biden. And so what happens then is they wait and see, is there also an objection from the Senate? If a U.S. senator does not give an objection, then that objection goes nowhere. Then Mike Pence basically says objection is not seconded in the Senate. And so therefore, we move on, we accept those, and we move on. Now, if a senator does stand up, a Republican senator, and says, I object also, that's when the Senate and the House go into their separate chambers and they debate that particular state's electoral votes. And they have a vote on those electoral votes. What I'm telling you is that the House, we know, is going to vote to say the Democrat electors count for Pennsylvania and we're throwing out the Republican votes. In the Senate, what I'm saying is even if Republicans control the Senate by two votes, there's no way in the world that you're going to get 48 Republican senators to throw out those Democrat elector votes. It's just not going to happen, okay? Right. So therefore, what happens is both houses voted to award the 20 Joe Biden Electoral College votes to Pennsylvania. They come back in session with Mike Pence, and that's now decided, and it goes on to the next state. Now, let's pretend hypothetically that the Senate actually really did vote, all Republicans stuck together and said, no, we say Pennsylvania's Republican electors are the ones who count. It goes back before Mike Pence, and it's a split. The House and the Senate are split on this, and so it's not decided which state gets those electoral votes. According to the Associated Press, federal law states if you have a split between the two, then the decider is the governor of that state. Which one did the governor of that state certify? Well, in all of the key states, the governors certified the Democrat electors, so the governor's decision ends up being the tiebreaker, which again eliminates any path for Donald Trump. Now, if the governor in that case, if for some reason the governor decided to change his mind and say, no, I'm changing or whatever, and he was legally allowed to do that, worst case scenario, what you brought up about the Donald Trump winning, that would be what's called a contingent election. That's where the final decision is nobody gets those 20 votes from Pennsylvania, not Biden, not Trump. If that happened in three states, Pennsylvania and two others, then Joe Biden and Donald Trump, both of them are under 270 for the final count. If that actually happened, then it goes to what the Constitution calls a contingent election, where the U.S. House of Representatives elects the president. But it's not one vote per House member, because Democrats would win for sure. It's one vote per state. So a total of 50 states would be voting. There'd be 50 votes total. And each state votes according to which party controls the delegation of that state. In other words, that state have more Republican House members and Republican senators than Democrat or vice versa. The current makeup in America is 26 Republican and 24 Democrat as far as the amount of members of Congress in those states. So therefore, in a contingent election, yes, Donald Trump would win. My point is it's not going to make it to the contingent election.
Sure.
Because the Senate will never agree to throw out those votes. And even if they did, the governors have already certified them for Joe Biden, and that becomes a tiebreaker. So there's no place to go with this, even though some Trump supporters are getting excited about the possibility.
And I guarantee less than 1/10 of 1% of all voting Americans have no clue what you just described. No, really.
I know.
You did a fabulous job. I've never heard that laid out that way.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
And you know what? You make a really good point. Okay, about as Christians, we often lament the biblical illiteracy that exists in this country. We know about that, and in the churches, as Americans and citizens, there's a lot of civic and political illiteracy as well. People don't really know. And you're right. I mean, 1/10 of a percent of people would not even know this kind of information. Most people don't. But the only reason I throw it out there is I don't want false hope to be created by a bunch of Trump supporters. And I also don't want conservatives and Christians to look like a bunch of, you know, idiots because we're forwarding email going, I'm telling you, Trump is going to win, contingent election, it's going to happen. And it's like, no, we're just, you know, we're preparing egg to be on our face. So he's not going to win. As John said, the fat lady has sung. And so I'll tell you what, let's do this because there's a lot more to talk about. And Neil, actually, I want to get from you also where we go from this point. How do we move forward after swallowing this bitter pill? That's what we're going to talk about, folks, in the second half of this National Crawford Roundtable podcast. And you can listen to the second half online by going to crawford.live. You can also subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more. And we'd love it if you give us a nice big 5-star review. Thank you very much for that. But we'll continue the second half next.
This has been a Crawford Broadcasting production.
Continuing the second half of this National Crawford Roundtable podcast with myself, Bob Duco of the Bob Duco Show out of Detroit, with Roger Marsh of The Bottom Line from the People's Republic of California, with Neil Q. Boron of Neil Boron Live from Buffalo, New York, and John Rush holding down the fort for the state of Colorado, hosting Rush to Reason. Talking about where we stand with the election. So, Neil, let me come back to you then and ask you how we look at this going forward, because I think a lot of us see this as a rigged election, a stolen election. I personally do. And there are many different ways, the media, big tech, suppressing news stories, not to mention ballot stuffing and the shenanigans that went on election night. And so I think there are a lot of different reasons to legitimately say this election was rigged. A poll even showed 30% of Democrats admitted, yeah, it looks like this was stolen from Donald Trump, but we're glad. Okay. But it doesn't do us any good to sit around and keep singing that same tune forever. It was stolen. It was stolen. It was a robbery. There comes a point where we have to say, okay, it happened. It was wrong. It was electoral injustice. But now we need to move forward. We need to think about where we go from here. We can't just give up and curl up. And so how do we move forward in this, Neil, put this behind us, accept the injustice of what happened, and say, now we live to fight another day? Georgia, 2022, 2024. How do we pick ourselves up from this?
Well, I think, honestly, we need to use it as a learning experience. And I would assume that people say, no, we need to continue to fight and whatever else. And yeah, I would say fight for truth and freedom and values and, you know, to uphold the Constitution. And we did talk about this last week, to continue to be believers, right? First and foremost, following after the Lord Jesus Christ and fulfilling our responsibility as believers to make disciples, and all of that kind of rolled into one. But I think the thing that I really don't want to see is that we turn into a bunch of whiners who just complain that the election was stolen, and, you know, that we just keep repeating that mantra over and over again. I don't know how that can be productive in the long run. It maybe, you know, maybe the Democrats would make a case to say, look at, well, you know, we whined and complained for 4 years saying that our election was stolen, and it gave us the impetus to go out and get Joe Biden elected. But I'm not sure that would work with Republicans, because they're going to say you didn't elect Joe Biden, you stole the election from Donald Trump. And I just think that continually we'll see it as a negative. So I don't know. I say that we use it as a learning tool and get busy right now to try to work on things like voter registration and standardizing elections somehow. I don't know how you do that, but refining the election process. Are you kidding me? We're still using paper ballots in 2022 by the time we do the midterm elections. There's just so much craziness that went on. Roger mentioned the 300 lawsuits Democrats filed prior to the election to try to get all these changes made leading up to Election Day. I think that's where we need to be focusing our effort right now, because there really was a red wave. The only thing is Donald Trump didn't end up being president. You know, we flipped three state houses and made gains in the House of Representatives, potentially held on to the Senate. It was really encouraging, actually, to see what happened on Election Day, except that Donald Trump didn't get elected. So I say use it as a learning tool and as motivation for the future.
Right. Roger, what do you think? How do we move forward from here?
Well, something similar happened in 2016 and 2018 here in the People's Republic, and I think it may be able to, you know, bode well for us as conservatives on the national level, but it really just boils down to the fact that the conservative movement has historically, and I'd be curious to get all your guys' take on this, the conservative movement has a tendency to think, we know what the rules are, we don't have to do any work behind the scenes until we get the rug pulled out from underneath us by the left. And I'll give you an example. Ballot harvesting. Ballot harvesting is a practice where you can actually make arrangements to drop somebody's ballot off for them, quote unquote. After the 2016 election, even though the People's Republic of California went overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton and was just overwhelmingly, you know, we're drowning in blue and it's not just the Pacific Ocean. In 2018, there were six Republican strongholds, primarily in Orange County, that nobody thought anything about, you know, whether or not there was going to be an issue of these people getting reelected. And all of them flipped blue. And people couldn't imagine that that would even happen. So many people moved in within a two-year period. Well, it turned out there was a huge amount of ballot harvesting that went on, where Democrats were driving around on Election Day, picking up ballots from other people, whether they had voted or not. If they hadn't voted, I'm sure they made sure that they got the ballot filled out, quote-unquote, the way the voters wanted them to go. And they just overwhelmed the polls. It was watching election night and seeing the results coming in and saying, oh, Mimi Walters is going to win the 45th district. 2 days, and she had an insurmountable lead. 2 days later, Katie Porter kills her at a landslide. I mean, it was amazing to see how these seats flipped. Now, here's the good news, if I can offer any encouragement. Three of those seats in 2020 flipped back to Republican because the Republicans jumped up and said, wait a minute, if ballot harvesting is legal, we're going to do it too. And so you really do have to fight fire with fire. And at the fact that there were so many challenges to existing election law because of COVID, you know, that's where most of these things came up. Oh, well, we have to do, you know, we're going to change our absentee ballot procedures, you know, and so it's not just a question of that you have to register for it, but now everyone's going to get a vote by mail thing. Well, the Republicans would stand back and say, well, that'll never stand up in court. Guess what? It stood up in court. I mean, we have to understand that this is what the left will do to get what they want. And Bob, I think you mentioned in 2016, it was about 80,000 popular votes turned into electoral college victories for Donald Trump. From what I've read, the Joe Biden flip them back number was around 47,000. It wasn't like it was that many people. I mean, there were lots of illegal ballots and questionable voting, but when it came right down to the ones that count and where the Electoral College was won or lost, the GOP was asleep at the switch. And I say this in love and respect to the legal team that was going after this after the fact. It did look like a clown car. I mean, toward the end, with the Giuliani, Jen Ellis, Sidney Powell type of stuff, they're out there, you know, arguing whether or not the machines were validated and whatever. I mean, for crying out loud, it was way too little, way too late. And I think the GOP, on the whole, as a party, better be prepared for the fact that there will be people who have voted Republican forever who are going to say, if this is the way you guys are going to operate, maybe we get a new third party out of this on a national.
All right, now let me ask you something, though, Roger. Are you advocating, I want to make sure I heard you correctly, are you advocating that Republican voters just accept the fact that ballot harvesting and mass mail balloting that's not verified is the wave of the future, and so we might as well just embrace it and learn to do it right? Because if that's the case, I'm going to push back on that, because we know that both of those things are prime opportunities for Democrats and liberals in this country to commit fraud that I don't think most Republicans or conservatives are going to be willing to do.
Well, to your point, and I'm not suggesting that we should just say this is the way it is and we should be just as dirty as they are, but there's some form of ballot harvesting legal in 26 states. So it's not just the People's Republic of California. There is some level where one person has the opportunity to get their hands on 5 to 10 other ballots in the guise of, oh, this is my grandfather, this is my neighbor who can't get out, I'm going to go ahead and cast the vote for them. I guess my general point, more than anything in particular, is to say the GOP for too long usually winds up doing the Timothy Busfield and Field of Dreams saying, hey, when did all these laws change? After the election. I'm just saying, hey, be proactive. I mean, if the laws are changing, rather than saying that'll never stand up in court, challenge it in court. I mean, for crying out loud, if what the Democrats did, I mean, for crying out loud, was it Pennsylvania wound up changing their election law at the bench level? I mean, judicial level. It was legislating from the bench so close to the actual election, and no one had the wherewithal to be able to mount a legal challenge to stop it. I mean, right. Even the U.S. Supreme Court was kicking stuff back, Bob. So, I mean, I'm just the reality is not that we should be engaging and saying, well, this is the new normal and we have to engage in that. I think my frustration is more in the how did all these brilliant minds on the conservative side of the equation miss the fact that these things were going to be able to stand up in court?
Right. Roger, why don't we do this? Because I know we got to take a short break, and I'd love to, after the break, to toss it over to John and get John's take on this. Because I got to tell you, and John, just ahead of time, I have a real concern about mass mail-in ballots that are not verified, don't have to be verified, and that becoming the new normal in this country. Because if it does, I think it creates the vehicle for all kinds of fraud that's going to be almost impossible to try to weed out. But just my thought on that, Roger. But like I say, I know we got to take a break, but then we'll toss it over to John after that.
Yeah, let's do that. We'll break here, because as we try to embrace the new normal, and Bob, I'm with you on that, the unverifiable stuff, that just makes my skin crawl. But let's take a quick break, and we'll continue to talk about voter fraud, election fraud, and what the conservative movement should be looking forward to doing in 2022 as this edition of the National Crawford Roundtable podcast continues.
Dr. Michael Youssef leads the way for people living in spiritual darkness to discover the light of Jesus Christ. This tremendous outreach begins with the proclamation of God's Word through the uncompromising biblical teaching of Dr. Michael Youssef. Leading the Way is here to equip and strengthen the church to stand strong and to advance the gospel in today's ever-changing world. Listen to Leading the Way with Dr. Michael Youssef at ltw.org/listen, and be sure to mention you heard about their program on the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast.
Continuing with this week's edition of the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast, Bob Duco, Neil Boron, John Rush, and myself, Roger Marsh, and we're talking about, okay, what does 2022 look like? What does it look like for the conservative side? And Bob and I have been having an interesting back and forth about how we handle this. John, what is your take on some of the laws that have been changed? They were done in an emergency, ostensibly they were done because of the emergency and the pandemic, but some of these laws may wind up sticking. What is your take on where we are right now?
I believe you're correct. Unless again, unless we as conservatives can mount up and make some changes moving forward along those lines. The other thing we haven't mentioned today, guys, is just the whole Dominion software,
right,
voting machine end of things, which really needs to be delved into, needs to be looked at more closely before any other elections even happen. Even a year from now, when we just do regular state elections, these things need to be looked at, because you have to wonder now how many other things have been affected even on a state or countywide basis because of Dominion and things that they want to see, put forward. Do I believe there's some corruption along those lines? Absolutely. But we've got to prove it, guys. We've got to figure out a way to, not only forensically look at these things, but then get that to the forefront, get it in front of the courts and make some changes. I know this is a pipe dream. It's probably not going to happen, but we need a revamp of the entire voting system and how we do things. I've said this before, not only on my show, but here on the podcast as well. I know states have rights. I don't want to take those away, but guys, we need some sort of a regular national, the same type voting system across this country, not run by Dominion, by the way, whereby everybody knows that when they cast a ballot, it is legally, legitimately counted. And we don't have all this shenanigans going on that are happening across the country. That has got to be fixed. How it's fixed, I don't know that I'm the smartest guy in the room to handle that, guys, but I can tell you one thing, it does need fixed.
Right, that it does. Which, there's part of me, you Brent mentioned the Dominion voting systems. I hate to bring up Florida and 2000, but there's part of me that just wonders, are we better off dealing with dimpled chads than the electronic kind of Dominion system stuff?
Yes.
I would almost rather have
a
physical piece of paper that everybody has to put a mark on. And if you can't figure, if you can't follow instructions correctly to mark that, then fine, then it's invalidated. Okay. But
I agree.
Something by actual physical paper where you have people eyeballing it. And I don't care how many volunteers you have to get. Well, we usually do this with 100 volunteers. Then get 5,000 volunteers instead.
I don't care.
Whatever is necessary for election integrity. Because I got to be honest with you.
The other thing I think we need to, for the integrity side of it too, guys, that we don't talk about much, is I still think a national voter ID law needs to be passed. I know you're not going to get that under Democrat control, but in 2 years, when hopefully things flip back the other direction, which most likely they will, it'd be nice at that point to have some sort of a national voter ID law.
Yeah. By the way, what do you think? What do you think happens in Georgia? Does Perdue and Loeffler pull this off? Warnock, I would suggest, is in trouble. Ossoff, he can present himself as a little bit more moderate, I suppose, and that's a good thing for the Democrats. But of course, he just yesterday referred to illegal immigrants as peasants. Not exactly the smartest thing. Can you imagine any Republican doing that? But if I had to best guess predict, John, I would say that we go 1-1 there. That Ossoff pulls us off over Perdue. Hope I'm wrong. But that Loeffler pulls this off over Warnock, because Warnock will be exposed more and more to just how radical and extreme he really is. But I could be wrong. He's got a dynamic personality. He plays the pastor card. He quotes scripture in a dishonest way. And he's got a lot of George Soros and Union and Hollywood money coming in. So, but I'm still going with a 1-1 prediction. But I don't know. What's your take on Georgia?
I think it's either 1-1 or 2-2. I don't think that the Senate is lost. I do feel confident, especially now that most voters know that Biden is going to be the president, and you would hope that enough have enough common sense, although that's lost in this country anymore, but you'd hope that they have enough common sense to say, wait a minute, the only way we're going to keep radical, Biden policies, and even though I didn't like Trump, I don't want Biden just running, rampant, and I'm speaking on behalf of voters because I like Donald Trump, so you know what I'm saying there. But the reality is, I think voters should be sharp enough to say, wait a minute, the only way to keep some checks and balances in right now is to keep the Senate in the hands of the Republicans, and that's what needs to happen moving forward. Guys, I could be wrong, though. Who knows? I mean, we all thought Donald Trump would be able to somehow pull this off early on, although I will tell you that back when COVID started, I think we even had conversations on this podcast about how COVID was a game changer in the Democrats. I've never seen a health issue used to the extent that the Democrats have used it to win an election, because that's really what this is about.
Never let a good crisis go to waste.
That's right, and they did a great job, guys.
That they did. What you guys get, Neil? What's your take on Georgia and what you think may happen in Georgia? But then also the significance of this, if the Democrats actually really do get control of the Senate, Oh, my goodness. I mean, I do believe that they would get rid of the filibuster, they would pack the Supreme Court, they would push for statehood for Puerto Rico and D.C. so they can pack the Congress with four more senators, several more House seats, and therefore several more Electoral College votes, not to mention everything else they would ram through.
Yeah, we'll be a one-party country after that. There's no question about it. And everything you said, I expect, will happen if the Democrats get control of the Senate. So it's crucial, obviously. I don't know. I have a gut-level feeling that Perdue's going to win and Loeffler's going to lose, which is kind of the opposite of what you were saying. But I heard Kelly Loeffler in a debate, and I really wasn't impressed. I was like, wow, she's not as sharp as I would have expected. David Perdue seems to be more well-spoken, and even though Ossoff, who he's running against, seems to be doing fairly well convincing people that he's a viable candidate, I just expect that Perdue's going to be able to pull it out and Loeffler won't, shockingly, because I don't think Raphael Warnock is anybody that we actually want to elect. And I don't know if any of you guys heard Tony Dungy's comment question, he calls himself a Christian? Right. So, I mean, it was like, go Tony Dungy. I don't know where that came from, but all of a sudden the Hall of Fame coach, Super Bowl coach weighs in, and I was like, yeah, you go, boy. But anyway, I'm thinking Perdue wins, Loeffler loses, so I'm looking at a split, but anything can happen.
It's an interesting point that you make, because I'm very open to the possibility you might be right about that. I guess I'm pinning my assumption that Loeffler wins on the radical nature of Warnock and that the Republicans will somehow get that information out to the people of Georgia. But Neil, to your point, though, and this is a very fair point, I watched the debate between Loeffler and Warnock. And I got to tell you, Loeffler looked like a stiff animatron from Disneyland who basically, yes, I am giving you several facts and here's some figures, but there was no humanity.
That would be a kind description.
Yeah. No voice inflection. There was nothing. And I thought, wow, she just does not come across as likable. And then here's Pastor Warnock, I say in finger quotes, just being a regular guy and talking and looking in the camera and engaging in that engaging personality. And he's got that Bill Clinton, I feel your pain kind of capability. Mm-hmm. Substance versus style. This is a classic example. Warnock scores 100 on the style and right. Kelly Loeffler a 0 on the style. But, you know, I guess here I am being naive enough, John Rush, to think that maybe substance will win the day over style, but I guess you look at Donald Trump and, you know, you got enough suburban housewives that are like, no, I care more about style than substance.
Well said. Guys, I know we got to take a break. Let's do that. I'll talk about that as soon as we come back. You're listening to the National Crawford Roundtable.
Dr. James Dobson left a successful career in academia to preserve and promote the biblical family in America. The radio broadcasting ministry of Dr. Dobson spans over 4 decades, earning him 17 honorary doctorate degrees and an induction into the National Radio Hall of Fame. Today, Dr. Dobson continues to champion marriage and parenthood through Family Talk. Listen every weekday at drjamesdobson.org and be sure to reference the National Crawford Roundtable podcast when asked how you listen to Family Talk.
And we're back, National Crawford Roundtable. Myself, Bob Duco, Neil Boron, Roger Marsh. And yeah, Bob, to your point a moment ago, you would hope and think that people are smart enough to look at substance versus just what someone looks and feels like. Unfortunately, because of our public education system and what even happens in the college level, I talked about, you know, Jill Biden yesterday and her dissertation that got her to be a doctor, which she's not a medical doctor, by the way. We should talk right. about that in the future, by the way. But as a side note, we have an entire society now that's built on feelings only, not facts, unfortunately.
Right. And that's what's really frustrating about this. Now, John, if the Democrat, let me throw something out here, actually. I want to, if it's okay with all the negativity that we're facing, and I don't know, could the Democrats get control of the Senate? There is a positive spin to look at what happened on election night. And I'd love to get the roundtable's thoughts on this. And John, we'll start with you. First of all, the big prize, the White House, yes, that was lost. And I would argue through a dishonest, rigged, corrupt election, okay, so be it.
Well, okay, but hang on, real quick, and I know we're running out of time, but real quick. Yes, Bob, that's part of it. But Donald Trump's his own worst enemy sometimes. I mean, I love the guy, but we even talked on the podcast about things that had I been his advisor, I would have done things much differently, especially these last couple of years, knowing you're heading into an election. And either he wasn't listening or there wasn't anybody around him with enough kahunas to say, Donald, we've got to change our approach or we're not going to win the next election, especially when COVID hit. You know, he's his own worst enemy at times, guys. He really is.
And look, I agree with you. I agree with what you're saying. I do. All right. For me, that doesn't invalidate the fact that this was a rigged, corrupt, stolen election.
Agree.
And Donald Trump, with all of his faults and all of his flaws and all of his miscues and all of his shooting himself in the foot, still would have easily won this election if it would have been a clean and fair election, okay, with all of his faults. He needed everything you're talking about to overcome the padding that the Democrats corruptly gave.
Where that's where we as conservatives are not real smart sometimes. We know these guys are going to do these things. So why are we not, you know, it's like the ball game we've talked about in the past that my kids used to play as a Christian school against public schools, and the refs were always slanted in favor of public schools because they hate the Christian schools in the first place. And we knew that heading into the game, which meant that we as a team had to play that much better, smarter, stronger, and put far more points on the board than the opponent, or you weren't going to win because you had to overcome not just the other 11 men on the field, but all the referees that were on the field as well. Donald Trump's team should have known all of that.
Right, and that is very true, and that's a very fair point. Republicans need to basically do 120% of what the other team has with their 100%. I get that.
Let me just add, too, real quick. I love, you know, athletic examples, but I'm just going to go for it again. The bottom line is Republicans play offense and the Democrats play defense. Now, I'm not talking about exactly what issues they're pushing. What I mean is the offensive mindset is run away from people who want to tackle you, try to elude them and get to the end zone. The goal on offense is to avoid contact for the most part. Defense is a killer mindset, and the guys who are best at playing defense actually want to hurt offensive players. They just do. I played high school and college football, and there's a definite mindset difference. I was an offensive player. I wanted to avoid defensive players at all costs. All I'm saying is that the Democrats play to win. They're nastier. They're craftier. And I said this in the last podcast. I don't remember exactly what point it came up. But I just think that the Republicans, we fall asleep at the switch thinking that, well, you know, the Constitution's in place and here's how things are supposed to work. And it looks like we've done, you know, we crossed all our T's and dotted all our I's. So it looks like we're going to win the election. And the Democrats are doing everything possible to make sure that the Republicans don't win the election. And we just somehow it escapes our notice. How is this possible?
Right.
You know, Neil, I wanted to chime in here if I can, because to draft off of something that you said with regard to offense and defense. The Republicans played the election like it was going to be held on November 3rd, and the Democrats played the election like it was starting on October 5th.
When
you get right down to the fact that we had early voting in all these different states. I mean, let's face it. The president had one shot to influence people. It was the first debate, and he screwed it up royally. I mean, we can all admit it. He came out rude and arrogant, and anybody who was sitting on the fence, he didn't have to let his record speak for himself. He could have just sat there mid-presidential, sat there and let Joe Biden try to attack him, and of course that would have been a disaster for Joe Biden. But the president, by the time he showed up as presidential, I want to say it was too late with all the other things that were in place.
Right.
And quite frankly, you know, if there was a lesson to be learned in the Trump White House, the fact that too many people, you're right. I mean, it's hard enough to find people who could stand up to this guy, and people close to the White House have said, you know, this is one of the most belligerent people you'd ever want to be around. I mean, he really is that way. But in the absence of a Kelly Conway who could tell, you know, the truth to him during the final 6 weeks of the 2016 campaign, I noticed that now she's a cabinet member. Well, why? You know, she's just going to clean up the mess on the way out the door. I mean, that's because so many people are bailing. But the reality is you could tell the president ran this one on his own. Basically, this is what I'm going to do, and had enough yes people around him, because they didn't have John Rush in the corner saying, Mr. President, with all due respect, finger in the chest, but this is what you need to do. And if you don't want to hear it, that's fine. But you have to have people who can do that. And on the Democrat side, they've got it all laid out. 25th Amendment is all warming up in the bullpen. Now here comes Hunter Biden's stories miraculously showing up in the media. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh, when did the scandal get here? You know, I mean, they'll have their pick of the litter as to what to choose to use the 25th Amendment to get Joe Biden out of office. I don't know. Maybe that's another podcast conversation. How long does he last? There's no way it's 4 years, but I'm thinking two might even be too long.
Yeah, well, actually, he has to stay in 2 years. The Democrats will somehow, some way keep him propped up for 2 years because constitutionally, if a vice president takes over for a president and they serve less than 2 years, that doesn't count as one of their terms, and they still get two full terms. But if they serve more than 2 years taking over a president, that counts as a term. And so the Democrats, they definitely would love to get 10 years out of Kamala Harris and not just six. So I'm guessing they're going to keep Joe Biden propped up until January 21st, 2023. At that point, she now is officially less than 2 years, and that doesn't count as one of her terms. But one of the things I'd like to throw out on the table before we kind of wind this up, and one of these weeks, I actually do want to have a discussion about the prophecies and prophetic leaders who gave their prophetic words that Donald Trump would win, and how do we respond to that? We don't have time to get to that this week. But let's at least look at some of the positive, optimistic things that we can look to from November 3rd. Yes, the big prize, of course, was lost. And again, I will say through corruption and a dishonest election and a rigging, combined, of course, I agree with Donald Trump's missteps. But here's some good things, though. There was a red wave across America. There really was. It was expected before the election that the Democrats were going to increase and widen their lead in the U.S. House of Representatives. And instead, it actually got narrowed to the most razor-thin lead the Democrats have ever had in the history of America in the House of Representatives. But then also, if we can hold on to the Senate, just get one of those seats in Georgia, then at least it holds back a little bit of what the Democrats would want to do. If we can ride out the clock to 2022, here's what's significant. And a lot of people don't know this. Every 10 years, of course, when the census is taken, the following year after the 10-year census, the state House legislatures redistrict their U.S. congressional districts in their states. Whichever party has control of the legislature in the states, they're the ones that can that are in charge, if you will, of sometimes it's referred to gerrymandering, but redesigning and reshaping their districts. The Democrats have had that advantage in the past. They had that advantage 10 years ago. But now, in 2021, you look at the state legislatures, Republicans control, at this point, I believe it's 31 state legislatures, and Democrats control 19. That means that the U.S. congressional districts are going to be remapped and rezoned, if you will, in a way that benefits more Republicans getting elected. That puts Republicans in a really, really strong position come 2022 to take back control of the House. Nancy Pelosi's no longer Speaker. It'll probably be Kevin McCarthy. There's also a good chance Republicans widen their lead in the Senate. And so it could be from 2022 to 2024, Republicans control the House and the Senate. They stifle Kamala Harris from being able to do what she wants to do. They hopefully expose her as the radical leftist that she truly is. And in the midst of all of that and the chaos of the Democratic Party, maybe, just maybe, that Republican slips in there and takes 2024. I think that that's a very viable possibility, whether it's Donald Trump or a different Republican. But at a minimum, I would say we're poised to be in a very good position to retake the House of Representatives in 2022 and widen the lead in the Senate. And I think at least that's some positive things to look at here. We're just about out of time. Yes. Let's run around the table real quick. John, what do you say?
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. I think you're spot on. Providing, the only thing caveat I'll throw into that is, you know, even states like Colorado, as Republicans, we've got a lot of work to do. And right. We at times, to Neil's point earlier, we don't play the game like we should. And we've got to make some changes there.
Absolutely. That is so true. And Roger Marsh, to John's point here, as Republicans, we do need to wise up, smarten up, and play the game the way the Democrats do, at least on the legal side of this, the clean side of this. But you can play really hardball and be shrewd and smart without crossing the line into illegal or unethical activity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have some of the sharpest minds, if not the sharpest minds, in the legal profession, in the political world, even on the judicial appointment. And let's not forget the fact that part of the legacy of Donald Trump's presidency will be outstanding appointments to the Supreme Court right. and to the lower courts as well. I mean, that really helps us undergird, you know, this kind of movement, not to say we're going to try to Christianize America, but to just, you know, make America more legal, more constitutional. And I think you got to play smarter. You got to play harder. I like John's point of saying, we know we're going to have to score an extra 10 more points, you know, just to get the whatever the victory is. But I'm very encouraged by the red wave, especially of conservative pro-life women who are going to be storming Capitol Hill, basically, mm-hmm. and taking over in the House of Representatives. And I don't see that letting up at all in 2022. So that the Republican takeover of the House again, based on the results of the election of 2020 on the presidential side, I think is very, very reasonable. And there's still lots of game to play. I mean, and right. we still have a lot of opportunity. We've got some young conservatives coming up. And maybe this was that cold smack in the face that a lot of conservatives needed to, you know, get up and get involved.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what we do, though. We, of course, next week, we're going to get into a lot of Christmas-related discussions, certainly. The week after that, we'll do a kind of a 2020 year in review. We've got a lot of great topics we're going to be talking about as we move into the new year of 2021. And we just want to say we thank all of you for listening to this National Crawford Roundtable podcast. Those of you that have been giving us five-star reviews on Apple Podcast and more, we really appreciate your five-star reviews. Thank you so much. You can listen to us on Apple Podcast or Stitcher or TuneIn or Crawford.live and access all of the previous episodes and listen to those as well. And so John Rush of Rush to Reason out of Denver, Colorado, Roger Marsh of The Bottom Line for the People's Republic of California, hosts Neil Boron Live out of Buffalo, New York, myself, Bob Duco out of Detroit. Gentlemen, always great catching up with you. Thanks a lot. Look forward to next week.
Likewise, Bob. Appreciate it, sir.
Hey, we'll see you. Thanks for listening, everybody. God bless you.
This has been the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Download and subscribe to the National Crawford Roundtable Podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more. Apple users can rate the podcast, and we'd appreciate your five-star rating. National Crawford Roundtable Podcast returns with a new discussion each week. Be sure to watch for the notification on your podcast app. This has been a Crawford Broadcasting Company production.